It's Wednesday, December 5th, 2007, and you're watching ArtCast TV.
Welcome back to ArtCast TV. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, and today I'm here in Chicago on an October day when I thought Chicago was a windy city, but I'm telling you what, it's plenty warm today, sun is shining, beautiful day, and today we're talking with a couple of guys from Bosch. Now, if you just thought Bosch was the guys who make like power tools that you see down at the hardware store, I'm telling you, there's a lot more to that. Bosch is a multinational company, a lot of systems, a lot of integration challenges. And these guys are attacking two areas that I care a lot about, SOA and agile concepts such as test-driven development. So we're going to learn today how Bosch is putting these things in play. So let's go upstairs in the Microsoft offices here in Chicago and listen in to Dave and Davey. Hey, welcome back to ArtCast TV. This is your host, Ron Jacobs. Today, here at the offices of Microsoft in Chicago, where I'm joined by David and Davey from Bosch. Welcome, guys.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
And so tell me about Bosch. You know, I think a lot of people have been kind of walking through the hardware store, and they go, oh, Bosch, power tools. Is that what Bosch does? I'm sure Bosch does a lot of things that we probably don't know about. So tell me kind of what's the context there.
Actually, Bosch is a huge company, about 250,000 employees worldwide, 160 countries, 160 plus. The majority of the business is automotive original equipment, brakes and common rail systems for diesel, and lots of other things that they do for automobiles. But we also have automotive aftermarket. We've got power tools, which you mentioned already. We've got security systems, a plethora of different things we do.
Wow. So, now, what do you guys do here in Chicago? What's your thing?
We are a part of the Internet Development Group, and we're responsible for developing the Internet applications across all business units in North America. So we have responsibility not only for power tools, where we sit, but also security systems, packaging for automotive aftermarket and the OEM. All that is our area.
Oh, okay. So so lots of websites, I'm sure.
Yep.
Although, I'm trying to think, do you have any direct-to-consumer kind of selling websites?
Yeah, we do both business-to-consumer, and then we define a difference between our consumers and our end users. Mm-hmm. Our customers or our consumers are the ones who buy our product. Our end users are the ones who buy the product from them. We have sites that go to both.
Okay.
Both to our customers and to our end users.
Wow, fascinating stuff. So now, I've been told that you guys are big into two things I care a lot about, which is kind of test-driven development and agile practices and that sort of thing, and SOA. So take your pick. I just want to hear which one you want to start with, and we can talk about what you're doing and why.
Well, we'll start with where we started with SOA. We started doing web services probably as early as 2003, and then moved into the web SOA world gradually. Actually, web services came first, and then came SOA. Our first major application was in 2004 for SOA.
Oh, but wait a minute. I thought web services was SOA. Isn't that it? I mean,
no.
If you don't know web services, that's not the thing.
No.
Okay.
I'm sure enough people have told you that. Yeah, right.
Okay, so
it happens to be how we do them, though.
Okay, so, I mean, what kind of things were you doing with the web services? Is it supporting external partners or internal
systems?
No,
generally it was making systems that we knew were going to be reused more available.
Okay.
So we'd use them as facades for back-end systems, mostly product data systems.
Okay, so you had kind of legacy kind of apps that were sitting around, and you put a web service in front of them to make them
accessible. Exactly.
Okay. And so if your early efforts were not SOA, but then you kind of moved into SOA, what's the difference for you there?
Many. First of all, it's having some deliberate goal in mind rather than just sort of doing it haphazardly.
Okay.
We started to structure our SOA initiative. We had a direction then, and we knew what we wanted to accomplish with it. We also started to standardize on the form of our web services and the interfaces, and we also developed our ideas about how web services are composed and what we mean by loosely coupled, what we mean by explicit boundaries, what we mean by doing them at the business service granularity.
Okay, so you had to... This, I think, is a critical point, because there's probably a lot of guys out there writing web services in your organization. And what I heard you just say is we had to kind of rein them in a little bit, give them some strategic direction, ways of focus and thinking about how we wanted to accomplish this instead of just like, go party on web services, guys.
No, I think it was more actually ourselves. There was nobody else doing it.
Oh, okay. But you guys had to get
we
some
had to
discipline.
Teach ourselves okay. how to do it, yes, exactly.
So how many, I mean, how many people or groups or whatever are involved in this now?
In North America, we've got about probably 20 different people in two different teams. We've got another team that does intranet applications and manufacturing applications in South Bend, and they also do web services also.
Okay.
I guess also twice. They do them too.
Yeah.
There's a difference in philosophy between North America and our European counterparts, which has led to a rich and varied discussion.
Otherwise known as an argument. Okay.
So there's differences in approach.
Yeah.
And we tend to be much more working from the bottom up. We don't believe that bottom up is the way you can do it completely. There has to be some top down, but a mixture of the two and sort of working from the middle out is a better way of doing it. So
oh,
we
sure.
focus more on taking vertical slices out of the business and enabling those than trying to figure out an entire SOA architecture for the world.
Oh, so the European guys were like, no, we need some big strategic vision, top-down drone
yeah,
kind of thing.
And that's understandable. It's a worldwide mm-hmm. company that
sure.
has to be developed, but we'd rather do it from the bottom up and then evolve the worldwide standards rather than deciding from the beginning what they should be and imposing them down, which is much more difficult than to implement. But
okay.
that is a difference, and there's good arguments for both sides.
Yeah, I totally see that, and I'm just curious if you guys are able to share, you know, what kind of conflicts arise when you got these two competing philosophies.
That's probably a question we shouldn't talk about.
Okay, we'll leave that one off. Okay, so all right, you started in web services, and you said you kind of had to put in place some strategy, philosophy around boundaries and granularity and these kind of things. Where'd you get your ideas from? I mean, where did a lot of people say, I don't even know where to begin, how to think about these problems?
It's interesting. Davey and I have had a lot of collaboration on a number of different things over the last couple of years, and it kind of works from both directions. Generally, I'm doing a ton of reading and assimilating ideas and putting together thoughts and putting together presentations and running them past Davey and running them past other people. Meanwhile, Davey's actually working with the teams, working up, seeing what actually works, what doesn't work. And so it's been collaborative over the couple of years to evolve a model that comes both from the theory but also from the practice.
Yeah.
And the Crucible was really actually, and no shill intended, but a project we did with Microsoft Consulting in 2004 or 2005 on a product data dissemination service, which actually ended up aggregating a whole bunch of services and then providing it through a BizTalk interface. I see I got BizTalk in there for everybody. it's the only occasion. To a BizTalk interface out to customers who need different types of requirements. And that forced us to very quickly refine what we were going to do and how we were going to compose services. And we've refined that, and it's grown over time, but that basic pattern has remained.
Okay, so Davey, you were watching these guys kind of try different things, and so what I'm hearing is you're kind of watching, they're struggling, they're working with things. Tell me about some of the mistakes that you think they made early on, and what did you do to fix them?
Well, again, so coming in from a services standpoint, we were kind of focused around doing small web services. You know, we have a zip code locator that we need to expose out to 15 different websites. And in the meantime, David was looking at kind of a overarching service architecture. So it wasn't really a matter of, okay, you guys are doing this wrong, let's try it this way. It was, hey, let's think about this way of doing things. Let's try to compose our services more broadly. Let's look at how we can build atomic services, and then we can build composable services on top of that, and define those processes inside of our code and align with the way that the business actually looks for services, rather than just saying, okay, we have a web service that will take in two zip codes and return back a zip code that's closer latitude and longitude, something like that. So it was just kind of a shift in thinking, rather than looking at doing it wrong than doing it right.
So we'd take ideas and then implement them and refine the ideas and then put those ideas out for review internally, and then that cycle went through many different phases.
Okay, so, but I'm just trying to think of an example where you say, were the early efforts too granular? And I mean, there was too many services, it got to call 10 services to get something done, or was it hard to know, like, when it was too chunky? Maybe when you call one big thing, it does a whole bunch of stuff, and you only wanted one small part. How did that work?
Yeah, so, well, if we look at all the smaller web services that we built, there was no strategy behind it. There was just, okay, one developer did it this way, and another developer did it this way. So as we kind of inventoried everything that we had, we had to make a decision on, okay, we've got to figure out a way to go here. So we implemented some basic patterns, things like using entity objects for at the interface level to be able to communicate data packets back and forth, data objects back and forth. So things like that. That was a small win for us. And then also using basic interfaces to dictate the behavior of those services. Those are smaller wins that we were able to do to say, okay, these web services don't have any of these things, but now we've got this entity object that everybody understands this now, and we understand how we can communicate with this. And then now we've got this interface that now we can start to create concrete classes, which will obviously then kind of push us into the WCF arena as well. So things like that helped us.
Yeah, so, you know, for during that time, you know, 2003 to 2006, I guess, I was doing heavily involved in a lot of web service stuff and thinking about it. I used to give a talk, which we have on our cast, called Patterns and Anti-Patterns for SOA. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the biggest mistake that I saw was not, you know, you hate to call it a mistake, it's just the wrong way of thinking, was that most people kind of began to treat web services like any remote API.
Right.
You know, here's a collection of parameters, and I'm just calling a function on that remote object, which I think, yeah, you can look at it that way, but it was almost the wrong way of thinking, which led to the wrong designs. So I was always strongly encouraging people to think about sending a message. You're sending a message. You know, take these objects, you stuff them in an envelope, and it goes over there. And when you think about it that way, just that little shift in thinking kind of encouraged people to do the right thing rather than the wrong thing. Did you see similar things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, another good example then would be we've got to be able to play with Java as well. So one of the things in shift and focusing is, okay, now we have a message, and it's our interface. So everything behind the implementation doesn't make a difference as long as we adhere to that single interface and that common interface. We can communicate across the wire,
yeah,
whether it's .NET, Java, whether it's PHP, or you know, whatever the language be.
So you have to stick with interoperable things,
yes,
you know, like
yeah,
not just shift data sets around or whatever, right?
Right.
So,
and
yeah,
our focus on those interfaces, and also keeping constant mind of being as loosely coupled as possible, just for the reasons Davey, that's led to our rejection of any kind of ESB in general.
Oh, but I thought ESB saved the world. Oh, man.
We don't think so.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and in fact, it's explicitly not an ESB service-oriented architecture. Because we feel like we've got more flexibility, we maintain more open standards,
mm-hmm,
and also the composability is better, and the interaction with other technology types is easier.
But, you know, most people have been sold on this idea that ESBs are going to save you because of the governance and management, and it feels more strategic, you know. It's like, we're just going to tell everybody that you got to plug into the bus, and the bus will kind of magically route and maintain and monitor things, but often they don't recognize that there's trade-offs that you make when you, mm-hmm, when you go down that road. It's kind of interesting to me that you guys took a look at that and said no. So then people are going to say, well, what about all the management, operational control? I mean, there's hard lessons to be learned there. When I put two systems together and now they're operationally linked, so this one hardly can't function unless that one's available, and you know, it introduces a lot of complexity. How do you manage that?
We manage that on a couple different layers, a couple different levels of strategy. For one thing, a lot of the problems that people have hypothetically talked about, we haven't seen appear yet.
Mm.
So we're sort of using the agile process of working up from what we actually need to do as to what's coming. So rather than design something for a problem we don't have yet, we haven't. We've kept it simple.
Yeah.
And I also think that a lot of the hypothetical problems are posed by those who will sell you an ESB to take care of those hypothetical problems.
This is a problem you're going to have. Now, let me tell you.
So how we can solve it. Exactly. So we have deliberately not done anything that we didn't think we needed to do, and we haven't had a requirement for a massive overall solution. And the question I pose to those vendors and have posed to those vendors in conferences is, what happens 10 years from now when you are now the monolithic application at the center of my entire architecture?
Yeah.
And I want to change you. What do I do? If I haven't been very, very conscious of choosing to use open standards at both ends of my bus, I'm stuck.
Yeah.
I might as well have run the whole entire company on a single platform.
Amazing. Very, very interesting perspective. Now, it reminds me of a principle that agile people often say. They say this funky word called YAGNI, which means you aren't going to need it. Or if you're in Nashville, like I was Saturday, I said, you ain't going to need it. Okay, so tell me what YAGNI, how does that impact you?
Well, I'll let David talk about our status object, because that's an example of something that we didn't start with, but then realized we needed in that first project, that PDDS project, and that'd be a good, I think, a good technical level example of something we built in just to do the monitoring you're talking about.
Yeah, so currently we needed a way to be able to do the status, do the auditing, do the logging, that type of information. I mean, we're going through four different levels of services. We've got to be able to have a way to be able to track that. So one of the things that that we developed and kind of grown over the years is the concept of a status object. It's a basic idea of having an out object or an app parameter on your parameter list. So that's a variable that we can then take through our whole stack of services, and then we can add functionality on top of that to be able to say, okay, now we have an auditing service out here that will accept a status object, and now we have a way ability to track that. Use some type of reporting services now, I can get a health monitor of how my services are doing, which ones are failing, which ones are not failing, and then if it is failing, then get a stack trace essentially of what's going on.
So now, so if I call into your service, I got to create a status object, and your contract says you have to give me a status object.
Yes.
I give you a status object that you're going to write to.
Yes.
And then if you call another service, you pass that along and so forth. Yeah. And so each service that gets it writes something in the status object, like, I'm this server, I did this
it's
with it.
It's essentially stack trace. It's a call trace, right?
Okay. Okay, so very cool.
So it gives us a way to be able to audit all that information and keep track of it. And it provides useful information back to the caller, to the consumer. Now, we've had a lot of internal discussions on the use of a status object and you know, where it came from, but I think it's been successful for us so far.
And so you haven't switched over to doing WCF yet, is that right?
No, that is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I would think there's a lot of very cool ways to handle that with WCF.
Absolutely,
that would be simpler.
Yeah.
But I mean, you did what you had to do, right, to solve the problem at the time, which is, like you said, it's a very agile way of thinking. Is like, well, so don't begin with this. Don't start if you don't think you need it. Don't do it. But I mean, if you say no, this is a problem we got to solve and we need it. You put it in just enough to get it to where you need to be.
And it goes back to what you said earlier about the message being important. We've now stuffed something else in the envelope that allows us to keep our services separate and loosely coupled. There's more intelligence residing in the message now.
Yeah, and I would just think that actually long way back, I wrote a spec for when I was on the WCF team. I wrote a spec for something that's exactly like what you're talking about. And of course, well, we were going to do it with infrastructure and message headers,
right,
and all that sort of thing. So. That's probably how I would do it, you know, in WCF.
Yeah, so today you can use WCF, and we can actually pass that status object to WCF to the framework there and have that managed for us. So absolutely, there's ways that we can build our own custom handlers on that, on top of that.
Yeah, you know, and then you can do, you know, kind of crazy things like attribute an object and say, you know, add the status to this, and it would all be in the headers and not in the envelope and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of power to it.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of flexibility. So very cool. Now, you know, so one of the agile practices, of course, is test-driven development. And I've been actually thinking a lot about that. I've been speaking at conferences about some lessons I'm learning about test-driven development. But my talk is entirely about how TDD has affected kind of UI development, which is an area that's difficult because, you know, you want to do TDD with a UI. How do you do it when you got a form and buttons and things and you got to click a button and all that? That's a bad plan. So, you know, I talk about the things, the techniques people evolve to do TDD with UIs. But I'm curious what lessons you learned about doing test-driven development with web services, because it suffers some of the same problems. Like, one of the big problems with test-driven development and UIs is that you have this difficult dependency to deal with. You got a dependency on a GUI form, which is not very testable. So people that kind of, you know, have this pattern they call the humble dialogue was the original name of it, and they dumb down the view and the UI to keep it as simple as possible and kind of extract all the logic into something else that's very testable. Web services could have the same problems, right? I mean, in that you don't want to have to, launch an endpoint to test your thing. But if your service requires some kind of behavior, especially when you get into WCF world, right, might want a transactional behavior or whatever, how do you deal with the context that's missing? So any thoughts on that? What did you guys learn about doing test-driven development with web services?
Well, I think there's a...
We're still learning.
Yeah, we're definitely still learning. But we've got... I think we approach it, and there's two ways that we approach it. When we develop our services, we typically have a consumer that want those services. Mm-hmm. So in that consumer world, we develop, whether it's a web application of some sort that's consuming our order service or some type of zip code locator that we were talking about before. What we do is we actually build out mocks of all those services. So that gives us, that gives all of our developers a way of being able to test those interfaces. Again, interface is what's important for us there, without actually having to test the transport and the instantiation of the HTTP protocol. I mean, things like that, those are better left for type integration testing rather than our daily TDD stuff where we write tests and write small bits of code. And what that allows us also is to be a little more flexible in developing those mocks. So if we need to change some type of service interface because our consumer needs a new function or a new parameter list, we can then change it without affecting the rest of the service, the rest of the consumers accessing that version of that service. So from a consumer standpoint, we develop it that way, leveraging as much mocks as possible, mocking out those services.
So what mock library you guys like to use?
We actually just develop our own.
Oh, you develop
mocks.
Your own?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just a custom mock set. And one of the lead developers that we had coined that if you have to debug your mock code, then you're probably not writing mock code. So that's one that we like to keep there. So so our mock code's very lightweight, and it's just enough to be able to say, here's an object that's coming in and returning it. We looked at nmock. Nmock can essentially do the same thing that we're doing. We just have it a little more flexibility around ours. So,
you know, that's amazing, because I would think writing your own mock library would be a lot of work. Are you just creating a small stub?
Yeah, so stub versus mock versus spies. I know there's some debate on what you can call which one.
Oh, okay.
But we're
okay.
Just calling it a mock, right?
So you didn't write the equivalent of nmock.
It's just a very plain one that, you know, we have factories that build out whatever object we want.
Oh, okay.
Return back to us. Yeah, so it's very lightweight, very simple.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. All right, I was going to say, holy cow, man, writing nmock this bit.
we didn't need that much, so.
As Dave, it's grown lighter weight, too. Initially, when we started doing them, they were very heavy.
Yeah.
But they've grown lighter over time as we've learned more about what we need.
Well, you know, you hit on something that's critical, I think, for people to understand about this, is the difference between kind of the unit tests and the developer orientation there and the integration tests. Right. So, you know, I always tell people, look, I mean, if you say, here's an interface, hey, WCF, I want that to be a service, and, you know, here's a client, here's an endpoint, okay, do I trust the fact that Microsoft tested WCF? We're pretty confident that they did, right, and that it's going to work. So I don't need to, you know, necessarily in every unit test test the whole infrastructure end to end. I'm just going to go right from here to this interface into something that's very testable in the developer orientation. But then, you know, at some point, you want to get the whole thing tested end to end just because of the way configs plays into this and, you know, the environment, the host process or whatever. We got to make sure that that's all working, right. But not in the unit test.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's something, again, we've developed over time, right? We didn't used to do that. We used to have a unit test that would test every connection into a service, and that's how we would test the business logic underneath. That doesn't really work when you start gaining traction on a lot of web services, and so that's something that we've developed over time. But I think we've hit a good stride on how we do mocks versus integration tests. We're still developing it. We've got another process that manages our automatic build, things like that, that go into integration tests versus mock tests versus where it's at in the life cycle of development.
So as it moves through that process, more of it's tested from the way it's actually going to be used.
Yeah, yeah. So I have to put in a couple of plugs here for some good resources. I mean, one is a book I really love. I picked it up about 3 or 4 months ago called XUnit Test Patterns.
Yes.
Fantastic book. And highly recommend it because, you know, sometimes there's these philosophical debates about what should be in a unit test, what should it look like, or, you know, this book is great for that. And then what you were mentioning about the process, development process, I did an RCAST with some guys down in LA called Spot Runner, and they had a fantastic episode about how they do their development process, They do continuous integration with Team Foundation Server, check-in policies, and then they have their whole thing set up where after it does builds, it deploys into virtual integration labs. So they can kind of set up with virtual servers what their deployment infrastructure is going to look like, push it all in there, run a whole suite of automated integration tests after they get their builds done. It's fantastic. I mean, my mouth was watering. It was so good. I mean, I highly recommend that for people who are like, holy cow, that sounds fantastic. It's a great ArtCast, and Marco DeMillo was their VP of engineering. Fantastic work. So anyway, enough of the plugs. All right. How many services and things do you think you guys have going now? Is it 10 or 20 or hundreds or
140?
Yeah, something like that. 140 deployable endpoints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these are getting regularly worked, exercised, a lot of traffic flowing through today.
Yeah, they are. We go. They back in a number of different systems: SAP, several different SAP instances, JD Edwards, and SAP's Master Data Manager. Some custom master databases, and then just the composition services themselves.
All right, so here's the big question. Now, when you said we started this whole process to make these back-end systems more accessible, was that goal realized? Are they more accessible? Is it working?
Yeah, absolutely. We've probably got, Davey and I estimated, about 70 to 80% reuse on the services, and we've even done experiments where we've connected into our SAP system, and within 15 or 20 minutes, we're able to connect into another SAP system in South America using the same services.
Nice.
So there's certainly
configuration changes.
Yes, yeah. Configuration changes. So they're certainly reusable, and they certainly are abstracting away some of the more difficult things to do, in particular with SAP, which is obviously a complex backend system.
So now, SAP and other systems like this typically have some other kind of API, right? I mean, whether it's COM or something else, that you can call into, so people go like, why do I want to go to all this work? They got some other API. I mean, they got one that comes with it. Why don't I just use that? How do you answer that?
I would say, again, that one of the values of the services, SAP and Microsoft work together for what they call the .NET connector. Mm-hmm. And we use that to wrap the business APIs out of SAP. But I think one of the things that we do with the services is we make it much simpler. There is, 28 different fields and structures that go into an SAP call for an order. And we make that much simpler for the user, the consumer of the web service. So yeah, I'd say that we've definitely made it easier to use.
And simplicity is really critical here, because we found just kind of going back in my early history at Microsoft, I worked on COM Plus, and we kind of anticipated with COM Plus that people would do the exact kind of things you're doing, that they would make sort of service-oriented interfaces. We didn't call it that in those days, but that, they'd create a bunch of objects and share back-end systems, and everybody would use it, and the world would be great. And we found in practice that they didn't. They didn't do those things, and in large part because the coupling of that technology stack is much tighter coupling, and a lot of it had to do just with the complexity you introduced in the system when you went that way. So people just didn't do it. So I'm always fascinated, to see how the impact of simplicity kind of helps to meet the promise that we'd one day integrate these things when previously we just didn't.
I think that's a combination of the WSI stack being something that everyone can grasp, and mm-hmm. XML being common, the fact that most people have got some experience with COM Plus or CORBA and seen what it can look like complex, and they don't want to do that again. And I think also for us, we've evolved our SOA standards to where it's designed, hopefully, to engender simplicity.
Yeah.
We've got some standard patterns, like Davey mentioned, like the status object and other things that help us do it the same way each time, and so there's a simplicity that comes from that repetition.
And cross-platform, you got people using from different platforms as well?
We do. Most of our stuff is .NET. And most of our stuff calling it is .NET. But we do make calls to Java APIs, in particular for the SAP MDM application, where their COM API has not kept up with their Java API, and we go against that with .NET through a product called JN Bridge.
That's a very important point, because a lot of times you see this happening where, like in that case, company's really about Java, and they go, well, okay, we'll make a COM API because we kind of have to, but it's a subset. They don't ever keep it up to date, or it's got issues, and so it's kind of nice to be able to to get to it with the most appropriate native API and then expose a web service from that.
Right.
Yeah, that's very powerful. Okay, some people are out there going, all right, I've been hearing web services for a long time, but I'm worried about performance. I mean, all that angle brackets and blah, blah, blah on the wire, I mean, that's got to be really tough. What kind of performance issues have you hit?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I would say we haven't hit any that aren't resolvable.
Okay.
Which is an easy answer to say. But every time we've run into any problem like that, we've been able to code our way around it.
Yeah.
And so we've never not been able to use a web service when we intended to due to performance. And this is for sites that are making 45 calls per page to display product information. So
wow.
They're not light duty calls. But some of it has to do with proximity. Some of it has to do with how we set up the wiring between the systems. But we've been able to get it fast enough. And we cache it. We've got caching strategies too, especially
sure.
on the websites for forward caching, which helps.
Yeah, I think the database becomes more of the problem than actual serialization, deserialization.
I see. Now you've hit on it. And this is what I always tell people is that, yeah, I know it looks bad, but that serialization is just a tiny fraction of what's really going on.
Right.
And it's like the first thing that people want to shoot at. Wow, it's XML. No, go in and do the actual analysis, and you see that's a small fraction. But the good news is WCF is even faster
That's
at
right.
doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
right.
really fantastic. As far as that goes. Okay, so, and the web services are out today, our ASP.NET web services and all that. Now you're kind of planning your strategy for moving forward to WCF. What thoughts have you come across there?
We've actually already done some piloting work on it. The way we've done our original web service designs with their interfaces makes it fairly easy to make the move to WCF. And we have some compelling reasons, again, for performance for some, in particular with the SAP MDM application, because we're doing serialization to deserialization from Java and back and forth. And the more deserialization we can take out of that, the better, regardless of where it is in the stack of calls. So we do intend to do some of the WCF things, which hopefully will go fairly quickly. And we've actually piloted some of it already
cool.
a short period of time.
So the important lesson was that you guys were kind of interface-based for some time now,
right.
which I absolutely agree was a very good idea, and it made it very simple to move forward. So that's goodness. Wow, so very interesting to hear from you guys today. Thanks for sharing your story with us on Arcast TV.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you.
You know, this is a fantastic conversation to think about how people are being successful with SOA. What I particularly like about what they had to say was they were trying to be very pragmatic. Focus on what works, start even at a very low level, and kind of build up from there. Of course, this comes from their agile orientation and good old Yagni. You aren't going to need it. So they didn't go for the big, gigantic solution that would have to be deployed worldwide to cost years and a lot of risk. But they went with some simple, small successes. Kind of a middle-out approach. Hey, I think it's working for them and could work for you as well. So we're going to have more from Chicago. So we'll see you next time on Arcast TV.
Arcast TV is a production of the Microsoft Architecture Strategy Team, www.arcast.tv.